What do you do on Sundays?
We talk about Cate Blanchett, the acting, the costumes, the awards, but mostly the Blanchett of it all.
Oh, I'm not acting.
You think this is a love affair?
I saw you, Erica, meeting in the middle.
This is Sundays with Cate, and I'm your host, Murtada El-Fadl.
Time is the thing. Time is the essential piece of interpretation. You cannot start without me.
Welcome to Sundays with Cate, the podcast series about the films of Cate Blanchett. We are in our addendum mini-season discussing Tar. And now that Tar is available at theaters across the United States, we're going deep with a spoiler-filled discussion. All things Tar, all things Cate Blanchett, all things Lydia Tar.
You want to dance the mask, you must service the composer.
And it is my pleasure to welcome to the podcast for the first time for this conversation, the wonderful actor Wyatt Fenner, star of the upcoming film Chrissy Judy. Wyatt, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm so thrilled to discuss this amazing movie and our brilliant, beautiful Miss Cate Blanchett.
Yes, I'm so excited to talk to you because we've talked about this film off mic for the last, I don't know, months or so as your movie played at New Fest where I work. And so we said we have to do it on mic and get on the podcast. So I'm excited. This is finally happening. So I've seen Tar three times. You've seen Tar twice.
I've seen Tar twice.
Yeah. So tell me first, sort of like just first impression of Tar.
My impression of Tar is that it's a ghost story about how we become haunted by our own deeds, you know, that you can't escape what's done. At the very end of the film, when they're on the river and Tar asks if they can go swimming, the boy says, no, we can't because of crocodiles. She said, oh, I wouldn't have thought they'd be so far up. And he says, yeah, they brought them for a Marlon Brando film. She goes, that was a long time ago. He goes, they survive. And I feel that that is one summation of the film. Things that you've done can't be undone. Both brilliant things in an illustrious career of an EGOT winner like Tar, and dark, unspoken things. They don't go away. And you can find yourself celebrated by the life you've created. You can find yourself torn down by the things that you've allowed yourself to take part in.
Yeah. Wow. We're going deep from the beginning. I love it. I love it. It's great. I love what you just said. But to set it up for people, if you haven't seen Tar, Tar is open nationwide in America now. If you're not in America, I'm sorry. Apparently, it's not opening elsewhere until January. So, you know, save this episode and come back when you've seen the film. But to set it up, Tar is about Lydia Tar. She is a conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic. And the movie starts with her about to record basically the biggest recording of her career. She's recording Mahler's Fifth Symphony, and she's basically at the peak of her career. Everybody respects her. She's at the top of the cultural hierarchy, not just in music, but in all of art. So the movie starts with her being interviewed by Adam Gopnik of The New Yorker and sets it up to us as this is somebody who runs this classical music institution, and she's at the top of her game. She's respected. People love her. She is. And then we discover that this story is not about reaching the top, but it's rather about tumbling down when you have hit the peak of your career and why that happens. And I keep talking about this film, about the plot in particular as a jigsaw puzzle that you put together as you go along, but it's basically she has made some indiscretions. She has used her power and position to seduce, she's gay, to seduce other younger women and give them favors, and that is sort of the revelation that leads to her downfall. The film also examines her marriage. She is married to the first violinist, played by the wonderful Nina Haas. And she has an assistant who kind of knows her more than she knows herself, played by Nomi Merlant. And then as the movie goes along, she sort of like fires musicians, fires her assistant. She hires a new musician and gives them favor. And the reason I talk about this film as a jigsaw puzzle is because I sort of explain to you what happens, but the movie doesn't even tell you that all of this happened. Do
right.
you agree?
Absolutely. Well, the first image in the film that we see, the film begins with the credits. And I think it's really beautiful. You hear Tar coaching a woman. I believe it's one of the people from the tribe where she went and did her tenureship, her studying. I think that's what we're hearing. Something that's so wonderful about this film is so much of it is open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. But the first image that we see of the film is Tar asleep on a plane. It's a live feed of some sort of social media format, and a conversation is occurring while she's being filmed between the person filming her and someone else, we don't know who. Within that conversation, it's said, you know, she's asleep, what time did she wake up, or she's just passed out. Someone says, one of the two say, oh, she must be wiped out. Then the other says, so you mean she has a conscience? And then the first says, no, she's haunted. Mm. And that sets us up to understand something is going on with Lydia Tarr that is outside of the carefully curated self that she projects, that we are then introduced through the Adam Gopnik interview.
Yes, and she keeps hearing sounds, right? Like, that's the other thing, that throughout the film, she keeps hearing these sounds in her apartment. She wakes up in the middle of the night. There's a clock going off.
Yeah.
There are all these sounds that maybe only she hears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the brilliant things that I love about this movie in that the sounds could be real. They could be, as you say, a ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something metaphorical that only she hears because she knows she's done some bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she's dreaming about. But also, she takes these sounds and actually makes a piece of music out of them. And this is sort of like what I love about this movie is that shows us the genius of Lydia Tarr, that she can take these sounds that only she can hear and make actual art out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And something that we hear in the film and something that's brilliant and wonderful that makes you, even though you know she's terrible, it makes you fall in love with her a little bit.
Yeah, seeing someone who's able to take the terrible position that they're in and use it for their art is quite inspiring. And I think that even though it's a really dark film in many ways, ultimately, I find the film very inspiring because, are we allowed to talk about things that would be considered spoilers?
Oh, yeah, we're spoiling.
Okay.
If you haven't seen Tar, I'm sorry, this is a spoiler.
Come back after you've seen it.
But
I will say, it's an incredibly challenging film because it's so multifaceted, but something that I find so inspiring is the end of the film. When Tar finds herself in an environment that she's never been in before, and we as the audience don't entirely know where she is yet, but we see a moment before she's about to go and conduct with this orchestra that we don't really know who they are or where she is. She's in her dressing room and she picks up her pill bottle and she sets it down and she doesn't take the pill. And I feel like that's one moment in the film where I see hope for her to move forward. And then as she's conducting this, it's like a sci-fi convention piece.
Yes.
The narration of this sci-fi video game film, whatever it is that she's conducting, and I don't even know what country
this
she's
is after her downfall. So this is she was fired from the Berlin Philharmonic.
Right. The narration says, if you can't go on, now is the moment to turn back. And if you choose to go on, here we go. And it's the beginning of a video game, but it's also like Tar's life. Like, she's going to go on. She's going to one foot in front of the other. And because of the moment in the dressing room where she does not take her pill, I believe that she is actually learning from her experiences. And like you said, throughout the difficulty of her experiences, she's also focused them and put them towards the composition that she's creating. But ultimately, we do get to see, I think it's open to interpretation, but we do get to see her carrying on and saying, okay, one foot in front of the other. I'm going to keep going.
That's so funny. So I have been talking to people about the ending, and people have so many different interpretations about the ending, which is what I love talking about. And I didn't think that at all. I thought the ending was not about her forging a new life or starting again from the bottom. I think the ending to me played like more of a comeuppance. And that she's at rock bottom, somebody who has been in the halls of the most prestigious cultural institution in the world, To go and then conduct music for
a sci-fi convention.
A sci-fi convention or an amusement park or a video game, whatever. It's not clear, but it's one of those things.
Yes.
And to conduct music from an unknown composer.
She couldn't find it in the music library.
Yeah, it's... So to me, that was her hitting rock bottom. I also think that setting that in Southeast Asia sort of like... I think it's a sly joke because these cultural institutions in classical music are very, very racist and only white people are at the top of these cultural institutions. So going there, I thought, was a comment on how racist these institutions are. Is that she had... You know, Lydia Tarr is not really... We're not told she's racist, but I can believe she probably is based on all the other things that she does. So... For her to be working in that environment, I thought this was, like, an indication that she's hit rock bottom. But I love your interpretation because, like you said, this movie can be interpreted in so many ways.
Yes, and everything that you just said is completely valid and a part of the story. And she is doing the work she's always done. Mm-hmm. She asks that orchestra, let's talk about intent. You know, she, in the Adam Gopnik interview, talks about Kavanaugh and the importance of intention in what you're doing and what is behind the music and how she believes that she learned from Leonard Bernstein that that is the way that you create your work and you do what she does. And then at the end of the film, when she's in what I also agree with you could be considered rock bottom, she's still doing the work that she believes in. She's still bringing her genius to the work. And I believe... The moment where she doesn't take the pill in the dressing room is a recognition of growth. Despite the fact that she's at rock bottom, she looks at that little container of pills and she sets it back down. And then the guy says, okay, we're ready for you. And then she's backstage and she's in the same place in Southeast Asia with this sci-fi convention that we see her at the beginning of the film before she goes and does her work, where she's backstage, she's breathing, she's composing herself. I find that to be... both things at once in a really beautiful way.
She's definitely doing the same rituals that she has done before, and that's just the way she operates, I think. I love what you're saying about the ending. But let me talk about, like, a theme that I love about Tarr, and I think, to me, is what Tarr is about, and you tell me if you agree or not. I think Tarr has two things that it's really occupied with. One is... what happens in a hierarchical institutions? How do people get to the top? How do they maintain their position at the top? What do they have to do to maintain that position? And how do they lose it? And I think there is, like, Lydia is at the top of the Berlin Philharmonic. She got there, as we find out, with the help of her wife, who's the first violinist, which basically means her wife is number two.
Yes.
In that hierarchy. And then she deals with the Mark Strong character, who's sort of like the money guy who handles all the stuff that she needs to do. So there is a hierarchy there too. And then we see her hiring people, how she deals with all of that. And the other theme that I think about is that how power corrupts and why it corrupts.
Yes. I think that the film also deals with the brutality of both of those factors of life, because in order to get where Lydia Tarr did, she had to be ruthless. Mm-hmm. And we see her be ruthless. Mm-hmm. Her Anders, her one of her former teachers, and also a high up at the Berliner Philharmonic,
her mentor,
who's not his husband, but his closeted partner.
Yes. They're all fucking each other. It's very incestuous.
They're all fucking each other. Everything is two-faced. Every single person can point a finger and say, like, you're doing this. And it's like, well, yes, so are you. And that is what this institution is.
Yeah.
Anders and his partnership with...
Sebastian.
And Sebastian. You know, Tarr fires Sebastian and is having lunch with Anders the next day.
I know.
As though it's just an aspect of what it is. And then also, I think that... the brutality of what it is to get yourself into these positions in the world is reflected in Tarr's physicality as a conductor, as well as, we find out later on, her history is... We only find this out because we see her field hockey medal, but we are given throughout the film Easter eggs about who she is, who she's been, even who she was when she was growing up. Mm-hmm. She clearly won medals as a field hockey player, mm-hmm. because amongst all of her music trophies, there's this field hockey medal that she mm-hmm. puts over her neck while she watches these Leonard Bernstein tapes. And it's like, of course Tar was a field hockey player. It perfectly explains why she tackled Mark Strong at the end of the film. It also perfectly explains how she was willing to get in there and mm-hmm. and basically like put herself in whatever position she needed to in order to move herself up the ladder. When she met Sharon, we find out she said to her, I need to know how Berlin works. Mm-hmm. And Sharon said, well, if we're a partnership and you come to me and you consult with me, those are our rules, then we can make this happen. Yeah. And they do, which is why it's so thrilling when Sharon finds out that there were things that were kept from her. And
yeah.
So
And Sharon is not mad that... is not mad about Tara's indiscretions. She's mad because she wasn't told.
She was kept in the dark.
You know, it was they always worked together. It was always a conspiracy between the two of them, and suddenly she was not part of that inner conspiracy. So yeah. That's what she's mad about.
Absolutely.
She's an enabler.
Yeah.
Nina Haas is amazing in the part.
Spellbinding. She's absolutely amazing.
So wonderful. I never noticed the field hockey thing, so I'm so happy you brought that up.
Yeah.
Because I want to talk about, you know, this is a Kate Blanchett podcast, so let's talk about Kate Blanchett's performance and the physicality of it. Like, yeah. First of all, I love, the field hockey thing was something I didn't notice, but that, it completely makes sense.
Look at her body while yeah. she's conducting, you know, yeah. like, she just goes there. I mean, I know that... a podcast isn't a visual medium, but I am moving my arms and my chest and my neck in the way that she does when she's just embracing what it is to unleash herself on yeah. the orchestra.
Yeah.
And when you see the field hockey medal at the end of the film, you're just like, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
In many ways of yeah. how she operates in the world, in yeah. her world.
I just thought of it as she's going butch because she calls herself a U-Haul lesbian. And
right.
I thought her movements were just her playing butch. But she was playing butch and she's playing, I think, somebody who played field hockey.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also love that when she calls herself a U-Haul lesbian the first time, she's, in a sense, attempting to relate to the Juilliard student who is a BIPOC pangender student at Juilliard.
Yeah.
She's... That scene, obviously, we can get into in more detail, but she's confronted with someone who is more compartmentalized than she's prepared to deal with.
Yeah.
But she has this opportunity that I think she sort of extends an olive branch by being like, by the way, I'm a lesbian.
I'm a lesbian, too.
That doesn't cut it, so then she tears him down
yeah.
ruthlessly.
So back to Kate's physicality, what I liked about her is that I think in my review, which I'll link to and you can read at the AV Club, I called her movement in this part both fluid and halting, which I found, especially in that scene in Juilliard, where she just walks around that lecture hall and you follow her in these wonderful, beautiful, roomy suit pants yeah. that just fit her so well and allow her to move so well, and she stops and starts, but also her movement at the same time is so fluid. And then you juxtapose that with the scenes where she's conducting the orchestra and where she's using her hands and upper body, and it's obviously the same person, and it's obviously the same sort of like halting but fluid movements. And I just thought this was Kate, as I've talked in this podcast, is a very physical actor who acts with her whole body. She's always very conscious of how she looks in a frame. If you listen to her interviews, she talks about that a lot. Mm. I think one of my favorite anecdotes about her, she talked about playing Bob Dylan. She was always sort of concerned with how she would look in the frame, her whole body. She didn't want it to have any feminine side, and she wanted to get really thin and sort of like look like a man or look male in the frame.
Mm.
And so she knows how she looks.
Yes.
And I'm sure she found a way to know how she looks as Lydia. And you see it in this film.
And something that you and I have discussed over drinks at Julia's and just other times hanging out is, you know, I believe an actor's job is to embody the experience that their character mm-hmm. is going through. I think that the best acting is the acting that occurs when someone's nervous system is actually experiencing the circumstance that they're in, because that's mm-hmm. when the audience responds by their nervous system takes it on as well. And I feel that as Tar, Cate Blanchett has a very clear understanding of something that they say throughout the film, the rules. And in certain circumstances, she's following a certain set of rules. And in other circumstances, she's following another set of rules. And in the opening interview, she displays simply with her hands when she's mm-hmm. talking to Adam Gopnik about what it is to keep time and guide the orchestra with your right hand and your left hand. And it's about 10 seconds of this physical illustration that she does only using her hands, but you see how fully she knows what that language is. And then when we see her sitting at the table opposite Mark Strong in the next scene, she's just so relaxed and composed and hardly moving at all, except for one point when she's frustrated with him and she starts organizing the cutlery on the table because she doesn't want to be listening to him or dealing with him. So she's just focusing herself on playing with the silverware.
Her contempt for Mark Strong is so...
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah.
And she does that in order to just get herself to the next part of her day, which is the Juilliard scene, where she's following another set of rules, which is to, in a sense, perform for these students, but also hopefully entice them into agreeing with her and appreciating her perspective, which they don't. Mm-hmm. And that makes things particularly interesting because you see when she grabs his leg, mm-hmm. one of the students has this fidgety leg the entire scene. Talk about juxtaposition. Her freedom in her body and this pan-gender student's, their leg, I should say, inability to keep their leg still. It's just...
It's kind of annoying. I was watching that scene and I was like, are they going to keep their leg straight? Are they gonna stop doing that?
Seriously.
And then she was annoyed by it too. And this is kind of like, I find myself sometimes in this film, like on Lydia Tarr's side, which is, I don't know, it's because she's played by Cate Blanchett or it's just because the film to me is not from her point of view. And I had this conversation with other people and I want to ask you before we go into deeper into Juilliard scene, because I want to do that too. But I always thought that this film is not from any point of view. I think it's very close to Lydia. But it's not from her point of view, because in the scenes where she does like the most damage, like in the Juilliard scene or when she fires Sebastian, or in the scenes where she's talking to Ander about Nazis and collaborationists and all this stuff, which is a delicious scene. In all those scenes, Todd Field films her from so far away. Mm-hmm. You see her in control. You see her whole body, you see everyone around her, you see the space she moves in.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, that indicates that we are not seeing this from her point of view. We are a fly in the wall,
mm-hmm.
Especially in those scenes where, like I said, she makes the most damage. But I talk to other people and they're like, well, the film has, it's from her point of view, which is why why it's not judgmental. I don't think I agree with that. What do you think?
I don't agree. I don't believe that the film is from her point of view. And I think that that's evident in the very few times where the film fully steps away from Lydia Tarr. One such moment is during the New Yorker interview, she's describing her foundation that she set up that allows young female composers to be exposed to Lydia Tarr, which also, of course, allows Lydia Tarr to, in some cases, take advantage of these young women.
Mm-hmm.
But in that moment where she's talking to Adam Gopnik about the foundation and what it is and how important it is for her to raise up young female composers, the camera pans way back and we see the back of Krista's head. We see the back of a redheaded
mm-hmm.
woman, and we don't know who that is at the moment, but...
She's one of the people she mentored.
Yes. And in that moment, I realized it's not Lydia's perspective, because it just stepped away from her and mm-hmm. showed us the world that Lydia exists in,
mm-hmm.
completely separate from her.
Yeah.
And there's just a couple other moments in the film where that happens, but that's enough to allow us to recognize, like, no, this is... Yes, it's a very curated life that we're looking at. So it's someone who has curated their life so specifically, it's going to seem like it's from their perspective. But that's actually a comment on what it is to be in this position of power.
Mm-hmm.
She's so curated and controlled that anyone who sees her in any situation is going to think that she's in control of that situation, yeah. which is the beauty of when the film starts to devolve and she starts to lose that control, yeah. which begins in totally wacky, unpredictable ways. Like her neighbor woman is one of the first like ill omens, you know, it's sort of like Burnham Wood is approaching Lydia Tarr's castle. And she's like, I've been thrown off kilter by just lifting this hurt person onto a toilet. Now I've got to carry on with my day. Those moments in the film are the wabi-sabi that, to me, make it so beautiful. You know, like the
What's a wabi-sabi?
Wabi-sabi is like the beauty of imperfection. Uh-huh. It's a Japanese idea, which is like things like if you look at a beautiful tree, it looks like a tree. It's gnarled, and it's mm-hmm. there's something beautiful about that. So it's like the opposite of bonsai.
Oh, nice. I'm glad we're on the same page about the perspective of the film. Let's deep dive into the Juilliard scene. So this is like the centerpiece scene to me. It comes very early in the film. Like it's about 20, 25 minutes into the film. And at the New York Film Festival press conference, Todd Field said that this was the first scene he wrote. So basically, he knew that this is what the film is about, or this is the scene that will change the perspective. And it changes our perspective completely, because before it, Lydia is just shown to be on top of the world. She's shown to be this genius, this respected person. And we go there and we're like, ooh, wait a minute. And the scene, if you haven't seen the film, the scene, it's just, she's giving a lecture. I have one thing with the scene. The student says, I'm a BIPOC pangender. No black person in their right mind will ever say they're BIPOC. So I don't know, Todd Field, talk to more black people. but anyway, he says that. As a black person, I've never heard somebody refer to themselves as BIPOC when they're black. But anyway, besides that, that's to sort of set him up, to set his identity up. Because the scene is about identity. The mm-hmm. scene is about the things that we're concerned with these days. It's a provocation. It's to show us a new facet of Lydia, but it is also to throw the audience into the deep end with Lydia. Oh, you think you love Lydia? Well, you know what? Guess what? This is what she thinks.
Watch her do this.
Yes.
And also, within the scene, we get to see more of Lydia's perspective of what she feels and recognizes she's up against, which is something that's expressed throughout the film, her idea of people as robots. Mm-hmm. She sees lots of people who operate in the modern world as simply robots. They're just listening to...
They don't think. She's the only one who thinks.
They're just reciting what they've been told to recite. And she yeah. feels that these students are doing this as well, which mm-hmm. is... It's up to us to have our own perspectives about that, which is...
Mm-hmm. I mean, she says so many things in this scene, and I wish I had the script in front of me, because one of the things that jumps out at me is that she says something about, don't be so ready or so quick to want to be offended. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you know, it hits. And I found myself when she said that, I'm like, you know what? She's right. But then I'm like, no, she's not right.
Right.
And
she also tries to lift up the separation of artist and art, mm-hmm. and that we can appreciate Bach, for example, while mm-hmm. having issues with him, you know, as he existed in the world, his person, mm-hmm. which is also a comment on Lydia Tarr's
herself
wanting to be able to exist in the world in the way that she does and continue to be on top of that world mm-hmm. without it having to take her to task.
I mean, Todd Field in that scene, he basically dramatizes, to your point, the argument of the art versus the artist, which I think is an argument we've been having for a decade now.
Yes.
All over the place. And I know that people, I haven't been to school in the last 10 years, but I've talked to people who've been in school and who've been to art school, and these discussions are happening in classrooms.
Yes.
So to see it in the film presented this way, and with, I think the big thing here is that Kate is doing it. So then you're like, she's so in control in that scene. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, she oozes intellect. Every word that comes out of her mouth, you're like, oh my God, she's right. She is the smartest person in the room. And she might be, or she might not, but she certainly acts like she is.
Yeah.
And it makes you sort of like, it makes you, just nudges you to her point of view. And I felt like I was getting sucked in, but then I had to like pull myself back and be like, no, not everything that she says is right or correct or is the way we should think about these things. And I think that's the brilliance of that scene.
Yes.
Is that you change sides the whole time.
And her confidence is magnetic. So yeah. Throughout that film, at a certain point, she plays, I think, 6 different variations on this very difficult piece of music on the piano.
Yeah.
And her ability to just sit herself down and do it. Kate literally plays those pieces herself. That, call it Kate, call it Lydia Tarr, that bravado and that willingness to open up oneself in a way that would be considered vulnerable, but it's just so empowering. Mm-hmm. It makes you want to believe what's being said, but the beauty of the scene is that a lot of what's being said is just outright dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And the suggestion that questions are out of line or are limiting is also very dangerous, because ultimately one of the things that she's saying to this student who is saying that they don't appreciate Bach is that by not appreciating someone for whatever reason, mm-hmm. they are limiting themselves in a way that is going to never allow them to be anything more than a student. I can't remember her exact language, but when she points at him on the piano bench and she says like, "This is, can we as a group talk about why they are never going to be more than this?" It's just so wicked.
She's wicked. She likes just, you know, she discards that person. She discards the student, completely tells them that they don't matter.
And until that moment, she does everything she does in that scene with a charisma and a friendly insouciance that just seems as though it's on this person's side. In the final moment, you just really understand how she feels, and she makes it understood to the student as well in such a cutting, horrific way.
Mm-hmm.
If a teacher spoke to anyone like that, it would just be damning for that person.
Yeah, totally. And for all the people who keep saying that, oh, Cate Blanchett doesn't do anything that she hasn't done before in Tar, I'm just like, go watch that scene, watch her play the piano, watch her do all the things that she does in this scene, and I think this is a new facet of her her screen persona that we haven't seen before. And talking about how different she is in this movie sort of reminded me of like the way she unraveled on screen before in Blue Jasmine.
Mm.
And that was all raw nerves and open wound acting. And mm-hmm. she was like
frenetic.
Yeah. And
exposed wires.
Very exposed wires, like in a nervous breakdown in every scene in that movie.
Yes.
Completely different than what she does here.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you think of her sort of like unraveling in Notes of a Scandal, that was a completely different role of somebody who's kind of stupid, a little, very stupid. Like that woman, Sheba, is kind of stupid.
Well, in Blue Jasmine, she's sort of unraveling against her will and wildly flailing through the experience of unraveling. In Notes on a Scandal, I feel like she's being unraveled. Someone is mm-hmm. taking advantage of mm-hmm. her inability to get mentally on top of it herself. So she's sort of being unspooled. Whereas in this, she's unraveling despite every best effort. I mean, mm-hmm. she literally keeps going for runs and going boxing and doing everything she can to get herself mentally where she needs to be for this not to happen. And arguably, like I said at the beginning of our conversation, I don't know that she fully unravels, because I think at the end of the film she is composing. Mm-hmm. She's composing herself. She's composing
mm-hmm.
a piece which so beautifully is called Monster Hunters.
Yeah. Yes.
You have to wait until the end of the credits to see that that's what that piece is called. Yeah. But the fact that that piece she's composing at the end is called Monster Hunters is so brilliant. But she's doing that, and I believe she's making choices that are better for herself from this point on in her life.
I think in this entire, Kate is unraveling with control.
Yes.
Like she finds that thin line of this woman should be unraveling, but she's also trying to be in control. And for an actor to be able to do that, to never show us somebody unraveling, yet we have to get that they are. I think the script helps her, because the script is also very elusive, so it doesn't show us everything. There are a lot of things, like, we never see her getting fired from the Berlin Philharmonic.
Right.
We
actually don't entirely understand what's happening until she tackles Mark Strong's character off of the podium. Yeah.
And that's the scene that, to me, is where you really... It's the only time in the movie where you see her lose control. And I think this is the difference between Tar and something like Jasmine, where she's never in control. But in Tar, she's kind of always in control. Or at least she has the hubris of thinking that she is in control when she isn't.
One other moment that I have to point out, because it's one of my favorite moments in the entire film, where she's absolutely not in control, is when Tar and Olga have traveled to New York. And
Olga is the new cellist.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Philharmonic.
And she's brought Olga to New York with her for a part of her book tour. And the evening after their book tour, they return to the hotel, and leaving the elevator, Tar says to Olga, "So I'll meet you for dinner in a half hour." Mm-hmm. And Olga says, "No, I'm jet lagged. I'm going to bed." And Tar turns into a schoolgirl. She goes, "Oh yeah, me too." and goes into her hotel room. And then we see in her hotel room, there's a pile of Hershey Kisses wrappers next to her at the computer. And that's one other moment where I'm like, she's lost it. Because she's falling for Olga at this point in the film, quite clearly, legitimately falling for this person. And then to have the rug pulled out from under her in that way, that it's just like, I actually don't care about you at all, is definitely another moment of the film where I feel like she loses control.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that this movie sort of like, the portrait in the film is somebody losing control, but also not knowing that they're losing control.
Yeah.
And also the hubris of just thinking she's above it all. Like, she could have easily avoided this downfall if she had not fired her assistant. The assistant knows way too much. Why fire them?
Yeah.
Or if she had just dealt with the situation and not ignored it. But Lydia Tar just thinks it's not going to touch her. Or even she
also just thinks deleting emails is going to make them go away. That's one thing that I'm like, honey, you need a little more robot in you in order to understand that that's not how it works.
Yeah. Or just talk to your wife.
Yes.
She could have helped you. You
yes.
could have helped each
yes.
other to maintain this life that you built together.
But she's scared. And speaking of her family, something that's so beautiful throughout the film is the way that you see her and Petra share their fears.
Petra's her daughter.
There's a scene where Petra's screaming for Lydia and she goes into Petra's room to hold her foot, which is something that they do to help Petra fall asleep. And after they've been there for just a moment, Petra and Lydia together look at a corner of the room. We don't see what is or isn't there, but we do see two scared children in the dark. And I feel like that's something that occurs throughout the film between her and Petra, which is another aspect of what's going on with Lydia, which is she's scared. She never shows it, except for those few moments where she's alone at night, having those 3 a.m. thoughts that none of us can escape. And that's something that she responds to by assuming more control. The success of that is arguably, that's up to the audience.
Yeah. So you brought up Petra. So let's talk about the other scene that I wanted to talk about, which is the bullying scene.
Oh my God.
I know the Juilliard scene is the centerpiece scene and it's brilliant, but I really think this scene is my favorite. So I'll set it up. Petra, Lydia's daughter, is being bullied at school by this other girl. And so she tells her mom or one of her moms, and Lydia's like, I will deal with it. So she takes her to school and makes her point out this girl who's bullying her. And this scene is all played in German, because they are in Berlin. And she goes to this girl who's like 7 or 8 and completely scares the shit out of her. She intimidates her.
She says, "I'll get you."
Yes.
She says, "I'm Petra's father."
Yes.
"And if you don't stop what you're doing to her," she says, "I know what you're doing to her. And if you don't stop, I'll get you. And if you say what I've said to you to any adult, no one will believe you. Because guess what? I'm an adult. But you better believe this.
Yeah.
I'll get you."
So that little girl is carried out of her life. And then Lydia just walks away.
She says, "Hi,"
yeah,
to some other mom who's walking across the
playground.
And
you just watch her walk away. And it is so brilliant. It is so funny. Like, this movie is so funny, but this scene is so very funny. Because who would have thought it would include a scene where she bullies an 8-year-old?
Something that scene also illustrates, which I love so much about this film, is that as ruthless and brutal as Lydia Tar is with people that she feels she can discard, there are people throughout the film that she does everything she can to lift up.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, she lifts people up until she has no more use for them. But
gain favor with
them. Anders is another example of someone who, she has a car service that she pays for him to think that the Philharmonic has a car service that they provide to him. And that's bullshit. But she does it because she wants him to feel appreciated. She wants him not to feel discarded. Arguably, that's because she wants control over him. Mm-hmm. But that's one example of a relationship that's like, she doesn't have to do that for him. And she does. And it's quite beautiful to see one way that she cares for people. Petra, as Sharon says towards the end of the film, is the only relationship Lydia Tarr has ever had that isn't transactional.
Oh, that line stings. Oh, and Nina, so great delivering it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I loved about the scene in the school playground is that this is why I think Lydia thinks that the scandal is not going to touch her. It's because she can deal with everything. Somebody's bullying my daughter. You know what? I'm going to bully them back and I'll tell them to fuck up and it's going to stop. And it stops. In that sort of case, the bullying was effective. But her bullying of her assistant wasn't as effective. Mm-hmm. Her bullying of Sebastian wasn't as effective. Making Olga a cellist and giving her this showcase in the recording that they're doing. It's a sort of bullying, but it's also to carry favor with her. It also didn't work.
Yeah.
But it's because it has worked for her all her life is why she thinks it's just going to continue working.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I feel that when Sharon recognizes that she has not been kept in the know in regards to everything, that's an example of a broken rule, and Sharon plays by certain rules. You know, it's like, it's back to the sports analogy, you know, it's like there are rules to this game, and if you break them, I'm out. So then she takes Petra, and that's that. Lydia has no more Petra.
Yes, this is a Cate Blanchett podcast. Yes, this is a Cate Blanchett movie, and she's in almost every frame, not just every scene. But also this movie has other amazing actors on top. It's, of course, is Nina Haas, who
brilliant
is so wonderful as Sharon. And I've said this before, but I'll say it again. Nina Haas makes this movie work because we talked about the elusive script. We talked about how it doesn't tell you a lot of things. It makes you figure them out. But it's so easy to figure out everything in that marriage, everything in that relationship, everything that ever happened at the Berlin Philharmonic, Lydia's whole history of abuse and power corruption. When they cut to Nina Haas and she looks at Lydia, or she looks at Lydia touching Olga's cheek.
Or she carries the path from Lydia's eyes to Olga, smiling at Lydia past her cello.
Yeah.
So much of Nina Haas's performance is non-vocal.
Yeah.
And it's so brilliant to see such a gorgeously talented actor tell the story with their thoughts.
Yes.
I heard that when Nina Haas was presented with the script, she said to Todd Field, I'm thrilled to do this. I think there's one aspect of this relationship that you might want to consider that I don't think at this point you have. And Todd Field embraced that. And she had done some research about Mahler's wife and how instrumental Alma was in Mahler's success. And she introduced that idea to Todd Field, and he introduced that idea to this film.
Mm-hmm.
Filmmakers who work with actors who improve the films by introducing ideas and by seeing an ember that is glowing and blowing on it and letting that turn into a flame that makes the film that much brighter are my absolute favorite types of artists. And Nina Haas is such a brilliant example of an instrumental role played to perfection in this film.
Totally takes this movie from a B plus to an A.
Mm-hmm.
Nina Haas did that. She's so wonderful in this film.
I love the visual differences between her and Tarr are also so telling. The first time we see Nina Haas's character, Sharon, she's unraveling because she's in pain. And Tarr and Sharon both have arguably an addiction to this pain medication that they both take. And they support each other in their dependence on this drug.
Mm-hmm.
But in that scene where she's unraveling and she's in so much pain, she's wearing this beautiful, bright, colorful shawl. And she's just immediately in purples and golds, whereas the entire film almost, Tarr is in blacks and grays, at most a muted blue. But we see that her counterpart is just perfectly opposite her, just reflects her in a way that is so brilliantly the other side of the spectrum. And I love to see that in their duo, even their chairs, They sit in their chairs and drink a glass of wine together at one point in the film, and Nina Haas's chair is huge and golden, and Tara's chair is this black throne.
Yeah. It's so what I've talked to many people on this podcast about how Kate is always so much better. Not better, she's always good, but maybe just more in tune when she works with other actresses. Like, we've seen it with Judi Dench, we've seen it with Rooney Mara, with Sandra Bullock. And I think with Nina Haas, she maybe finally found her equal. Not that those actresses are not brilliant or anything, but I think Kate Blanchett and Nina Haas sort of have the same background. They both started in theater. Mm-hmm. They played those great roles in theater, like Hedda Gabler.
Yeah.
And then they found their niche in movies and in these sort of brilliant character studies. Like, if you watch Phoenix or Barbara or any of the Nina Haas movies that she did with Christian Petzold, it's kind of a Kate Blanchett role Kate Blanchett would play if she was born in Germany.
Yeah. And as an actor, Nina Haas is also very clearly someone who embodies everything that's going on with her character, mm-hmm. with her entire being. Even when it's just a shot of her eyes, mm-hmm. you know that she's feeling that gut punch to her stomach when she realizes mm-hmm. that she hasn't been clued in to what's going on with Olga. And Nina Haas's embodiment of what's going on with her as a her character is just so brilliant, and it's just rapturous.
So in the gay circles we move in, there was a lot of excitement about the other actress in this movie, Noémie Merlant, who of course became world famous because of
Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Fans, I would think everybody who loves Carol also loves Portrait of a Lady on Fire, so there was a lot of excitement about Noémie Merlant and Cate Blanchett being in a movie together. Mm-hmm. Those two great actresses from these very queer movies. What do you think of Noémie Merlant?
I absolutely love Noémie Merlant. I first saw her in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and I was just absolutely blown away by this woman's eyes. Not just that they're beautiful eyes, but that she tells so much with her eyes. And there are several scenes in Tar that take my breath away, particularly the scene where Lydia tells her she's not going to be given the position, that she's effectively been working for her entire mm-hmm. career as Lydia's assistant. Noémie Merlant realizes she's about to receive news, and you see this person immediately shallow their breath, mm-hmm. and she's just waiting. And as it becomes clear to her that Lydia's not giving her the position, she just rolls her eyes, lets the breath out, and then the scene ends. And we don't see her again in the film, but we know in her absence what she's up to, where she is, everything mm-hmm. that's going on with her, which is vengeance. It's like in that moment when you see her realize what's happening and you see her release the tension that she's mm-hmm. been holding on the entire film, mm-hmm. you know so much about what this woman is going mm-hmm. to be up to. Yeah. And I also think that throughout the film, up until that point, it's so clear through her performance what the trifecta of Krista, Lydia, and Francesca was. Without ever seeing, we mm-hmm. see the back of Krista's head, but without ever seeing the three of them at work, it's so clear, based on how Francesca deals with Tar, how much she cares about Krista mm-hmm. and how much she genuinely aches for the threesome that they were to be mm-hmm. able to be there again.
Yeah.
And I just think that it's absolutely, absolutely gorgeous and beautiful, beautiful acting.
She does so much in that scene that you were talking about, where she's basically told that she's not going to be Lydia's assistant or whatever it's called, vice conductor. And you're right. It's just all in the eyes. It's very little things. And I think that's the moment where she decides, I'm going to be the architect of Tar's destruction.
Absolutely.
And it's the flip of her eyes. She does this one thing with the eyes and you're like, oh my God, you know,
she's taking her down. Yeah, she's taking her down. And it's like, it doesn't fucking matter if she, you know, obeyed it's like in that moment you realize that she has had a contract with Tar, whether or not it was ever spoken. She had a contract with Tar that she was committed to. And when Tar broke that contract by not giving her the position, she said, I'm going to burn the house down.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Yeah. Why, I could talk to you about this movie forever. Is there something that we have missed that you want to talk about?
Something that I love that the film does is it plays with language, and it plays with the specificity of language.
Mm-hmm.
After Lydia has fallen and hurt herself, and she's at the doctor, and she's complaining about her shoulder, the doctor says to her, "It's notasia." And she says, "Nostalgia." And he says, "No, notasia. It's the name of whatever is happening with her nerves." And that she effectively says, "Nostalgia is what's causing me pain," is what I think, to the beginning of our conversation, the film is about. Because nostalgia, mm-hmm. a reflection of where you've been, a reflection on who you are as a result of what you've done with your life, what is done cannot be undone, is exactly what this movie is. So the fact that in that moment, the doctor says, "No, not nostalgia, Natasia." I don't know if I can say it correctly.
I mean, the film, the script is so wonderful. Like, there's so many plays on language, and it's so funny. Like, you don't expect this movie to be as funny as it is, because, you know, it's like, it's a serious movie about classical music.
She says, "You're a misogamist." He says, "I'm not a misogynist." She says, "A misogamist."
Yeah.
Hater of marriage.
I know. Genius. I love it. You know, the way that she's so contemptuous of anybody. Like, you mentioned it, how she calls everybody a robot. And I know, like, she thinks that, you know, some people are robots and some are other, but I really think Lydia Tár probably thinks everybody that's not her, and maybe Sharon and Petra, is completely a robot, which is her term for people who just she thinks are less, which is probably everyone.
Which is also so beautiful, because one thing a robot can't do is feel. And obviously what she loves so much about Leonard Bernstein and about the music that she creates, and something that has been important to her entire life, we realize this when she goes home to her childhood home and you see her collection of VHSs,
mm-hmm.
is that music is an expression of feeling. Mm-hmm. It's a human expression. It's an expression of what it is to have wild, violent, beautiful, emotional experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what's so important to her, is just stunning, because it's the opposite of what a robot can't feel.
Mm-hmm.
So when she's going around the world calling people robots, she's saying, like, you
mm-hmm.
don't see the beauty of what I'm doing with my existence, which is
mm-hmm.
the gospel of Leonard Bernstein in that tape that she watches with her little field hockey medal around her neck.
Yeah. And the thing is, the movie is sort of like, it's the portrait of somebody who started there, right? Like, she started there. Leonard Bernstein probably was not her mentor, as she claims he is.
Right.
That's totally
right.
Something that she made up. But she probably feels he was her mentor.
She may have had a conversation with him once.
Yeah, or met him in passing. But he probably was her mentor because she watched all of his stuff. She probably read all of his interviews. She probably built her philosophy about life and about work based on him. So
she models herself visually after him.
Yes.
We get to see in the composition of the photograph for the cover of her album.
Yeah. And what I love about this film is that she started there. She started there as somebody who loves art, who loves music, who wants to have a life full of that. And then as she grew more successful, more powerful, I think she loses
mm-hmm.
that sense of whatever it is that was the spark at the beginning. And now she just becomes somebody who just wants to run the Berlin Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was due for a downfall.
Yeah. And I think that probably as Lydia Tár moved through her career, she realized the habitual stepping on top of people that had to occur. And it never occurred to her that maybe she should try to do it differently. Maybe she should bring that spark of humanity that was a part of what attracted her to music along the way, rather than allowing destruction to be a part of her path and, you know, like, casting people aside again and again and again. Although she probably, for the most part, had to model her behavior on men and a structure of success that was not regularly open to women. So,
Yeah, we could talk about this film forever. I love talking to you, Wyatt. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Before we go, let our listeners know where they can find you and your work.
If you follow me on Instagram, I'm at Wyatt Fenner. And if you keep an eye out for the feature film Chrissy Judy, it will be released this spring. I can't wait for all of you to come and see it.
Chrissy Judy is a wonderful film. I had the pleasure of screening it at New Fest. It was one of the biggest hits at the festival, and Wyatt is wonderful. I can't wait for more people to see it. Thank you so much, Wyatt. And you can find me on Twitter at @ME_says and follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at @SundaysWithKate. And until next time, more Tar. Thank you for listening.